Pamela McCall on CFAX 1070.
Good morning, everyone. Hope you're enjoying this gorgeous day so far. Hard not to. And welcome to Legally Speaking with Michael Mulligan of Mulligan, Tam and Pearson. Welcome back to you.
Thank you very much. It's so wonderful to be back.
You've been on another adventure. Let's start with that. You've been to the Galapagos. What's it like?
It was a fascinating place to be. It's difficult to get to. It was about a three-day process. You fly into Quito, Ecuador, and then over to airstrip that was originally built by the Americans during the Second World War to help defend against the possibility of Japanese submarine attack. And then it's a variety of small boats, ferries, buses, and so forth to get about. But we spent most of our time on the largest island there, which is called Isabela. There's a tiny little town at the bottom of it with a few hotels and places to stay. And in addition to being just a warm, pleasant place to be with white sandy beaches, at least in that location, the most interesting thing are the animals there.
Sure. Kind of why you go, huh?
Yeah, that is, I think, why you make that degree of effort. They've got marine iguanas, which are everywhere, sea lions, penguins, all sorts of things. And one of the interesting things is because there are no or few predators and there's been limited human interaction there, the animals haven't evolved a fear of people. So you can walk right up to a marine iguana and pull out your iPhone and take a picture of it from, you know, a foot away, and it's not bothered. And the same would be true of things like sea lions who happily just come out of the water and hop up on park benches and that sort of thing. And that's
Dr. Doolittle.
Yeah. I mean, the best analogy I heard, I think is apt, is the animals there would react to you the way a bird might react to a cow walking up to it in a field. It might sort of acknowledge the cow's walked up to it, but it's not afraid or fleeing. So just a fascinating and interesting place to be. It's worth the journey, but it does take a bit of effort to get there.
Well, thanks for taking us there. And for coming back. And now back to the reality. A former Sydney North Sanitar CMP officer, mandatory minimum sentence of 6 months in jail for possession of child pornography. What do you make of that case?
Well, it raises a few interesting issues. In that case, there was some evidence that the police officer or former police officer suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of events experienced during a 20-year police career. There was some expert evidence about that, and the judge accepted that was the background to this behavior. The RCMP officer, a former RCMP officer, apparently downloaded over 400 images of child pornography. So the judge accepted that was the background, and clearly this was somebody without any other criminal record, given that they were a police officer. But nonetheless, there is a mandatory minimum jail sentence that attaches to this particular offense. So as a result of the guilty plea, the police officer was sentenced to 6 months in jail. Now, it's hard to know whether there would have been a different outcome had that minimum not existed, but that's the state of affairs. In addition to the 6 months in jail, he was also put on a period of probation for 18 months, and there would be other ongoing consequences for him, including things like registration as a sexual offender, this sort of thing. So certainly a significant sentence, particularly for somebody with that background. And given the explanation which was accepted for this conduct. So it does raise interesting issues about the suitability of mandatory sentences and whether there ought to be additional judicial discretion, even for offenses like this one, given this sort of background.
Having said that, I think people hear child pornography and former RCMP officer and they cringe. So bring us into this PTSD and how that might have mitigated, or if there hadn't been a mandatory minimum 6 months, you think he would have gotten less?
That's hard to know, right? The fact that there's a mandatory minimum doesn't mean that he wouldn't have received a jail sentence regardless. That would be the even prior to there being longer mandatory minimum sentences for child pornography offenses. Jail sentences would still be the norm, right? That would be sort of what you would expect. And the issue for judges used to be sort of the length of those jail sentences. In some exceptional cases in the past, you would see circumstances where a person would be sentenced to house arrest rather than prison. Where a judge does that, it's called a conditional sentence, where a person's ordinarily required to be in their home either at all times except for work or for an hour to go shopping, this sort of thing. When those sort of sentences were imposed, they would ordinarily be longer than a jail sentence. But that would be the exception. So it's certainly cringeworthy activity, and certainly the reaction to somebody who's in a position of trust like an RCMP officer, that's going to be a significant factor. But in my judgment, there ought to be some possibility of greater discretion. Here, the explanation which was accepted was that one, as a result of a psychiatric condition flowing from this person's experience as a police officer. And there appeared to be expert evidence supporting that, which was accepted. So while it's cringeworthy and terrible conduct, there's a legitimate question to be asked about whether that in all cases would be the appropriate sentence.
Does it set precedence then, the linkage the reason of PTSD and the inclination to, the inclination to seek out child pornography?
I mean, I must say I find it hard to understand quite exactly how those two things would be connected, an interest in that sort of material. I don't know exactly how that's going to flow from traumatic circumstances. Sometimes, with some frequency, people who, in my experience, are involved with this sort of material, one of the common threads are people who were themselves abused as a child, for example. That would be a common background that would lead to somebody having these sort of aberrant sexual interests if they were sexually abused in a serious way as a child. Sometimes that seems to manifest itself in a person having interest in this sort of material. There's no indication of that in what I've read about this case, but that is a common thread.
You were in the Galapagos when the Gomeshi judgment came down. Let's get your take on the reasons for Gomeshi's acquittal.
Yeah, and one thing I should say about that, and it's an important principle, is that in Canada, when a judge is making a decision like this one, they don't simply make a decision. They don't come into the courtroom and say, I find you not guilty, and that's it. A judge has to give reasons for what they're doing. And in this case, the judge spent 25 pages carefully analyzing the evidence of each of the three complainants.
Michael, I've just looked at the clock. Yeah. Let's hold that thought right there. We'll keep people on the edge of their seats here as you set that up for us. We're talking to Michael Mulligan, of course, of Mulligan, Tam & Pearson here on Legally Speaking. We're going to get his take on the Gomeshi case right after this.
Call us 250-386-1161. Or on your cell at Star 1070. Pamela McCall on CFAX 1070. When it rains, it pours. Or will it? We get it right with an accurate, up-to-the-minute forecast. If it's happening, it's here. Victoria's News Authority, CFAX 1070.
This is Julie Skinner from Vision Travel, inviting you to take advantage of Oceana Cruises Canadian Residence Special with last call savings on now until March 31st. Enjoy 2-for-1 cruise fares, free airfare, free prepaid gratuities, free unlimited internet package, and a shipboard credit of up to $600. Call us today. Vision Travel, vacations crafted by professionals. 250-412-1888. That's 250-412-1888.
Our real estate market is hot. Have you noticed how fast the sold signs are going up? Wouldn't it be nice to have a commission break when a property sells so quickly? This is Kevin Ramsey, lead realtor of Fair Realty's Sweet Home Victoria real estate team. All of my listing contracts have commission reductions if the property sells within a month. A quick sale means less work and less advertising for me, and transferring the savings to you makes perfect sense. So remember, when it's time to sell your sweet home, go to sweethomevictoria.com or find Sweet Home Victoria real estate team in the yellow pages.
Victoria Royals Black and Blue Playoff Hockey.
It's round one. Royals. Chiefs. Game 5 is tomorrow at 7:05 at the Save-On Foods Memorial Center.
And the Victoria Royals.
Show the world, show Canada that this is a sports town and we're proud of it.
The playoffs are presented by Pepsi, Two Burly Men, The Home Handyman, and Gillis Plumbing.
Join the Royal March to the Memorial Cup. Get your tickets now at victoriaroyals.com.
Imagine a pencil pointing straight up. Now imagine an egg on the tip of that pencil. The egg spins and spins and never falls because it's perfectly in balance. This is your nest egg, kept in balance by GIC Direct. GIC Direct gets the highest interest rates on GICs and term deposits, a fundamental piece of any balanced portfolio. A protected nest egg, a balanced portfolio, peace of mind. It's easy to connect it, GIC Direct it. Learn more now at GICDirect.com or call 592-7707.
Oh, hey, it's me, Jeff, Peninsula Co-op number 44091. You know, every year, Peninsula Co-op members receive a rebate for the gas, grocery and convenience store purchases, home heating oil, and car lock fuel they buy. But some people prefer to use my number. Thanks to them, I got a huge check for $778 this year. But don't worry, I donated every last cent to the TLC Fund for Kids. So, keep using 44091.
Yeah. Stop, fill it up with your co-op.
Hi, it's Amanda, the Princess of Plumbing from the Super Plumber. We know that when you have a plumbing problem, you want to fix it as quickly as possible. That's why we pride ourselves on being on time. So much so, we guarantee it. If we're late for your appointment, we'll give you $5 per minute up to $100. That's right, if we're delayed, you get paid. Find out more at thesuperplumber.com.
The Super Plumber!
Dork Uncorked with Rod Phillips and Carol Morrison. Saturdays at 2.
Brought to you by the Pendry Restaurant at the Gatsby Mansion.
On CFAX 1070. The biggest news events, the stories in our community. Understood. It's Pamela McCall on CFAX 1070.
Welcome back, everybody, to Legally Speaking with Michael Mulligan of Mulligan, Tam, and Pearson. He's going to give us his assessment of the judgment in the Gomeshi case.
Yeah, I mean, the judge in this case did what he was required to do and gave a detailed assessment as to why he found each of the complainants to not be credible or reliable. And a judge isn't, as I said, just making a decision. They have to explain their decision, why they came to it, and how they reached their conclusion. And that's important in the event somebody wanted to appeal or understand sort of how it is that this decision was arrived at. Now, one thing that's notable about this case, and it's actually attached to the front of the reasons for judgment, is there's a section of the criminal code that provides where there are allegations of various types of sexual offenses, including sexual assault. It's mandatory on application by a complainant or the Crown for a ban on publication of anything which would identify the complainant. Mm-hmm. And those applications were made with respect to two of the complainants. The third one, the woman who was an actress, Lucy DeCourture, I think mm-hmm. is the correct pronunciation, she applied to waive that. But it's an interesting thing that two of the people here who were complainants are unidentified in a public way. And there's a legitimate public policy question about whether that's a suitable thing to have in all cases or not, and whether it should continue. There may be some legitimate public policy reasons why people should be identified if they're making a complaint of this sort. But two of the people remain anonymous, despite the fact that their evidence was rejected and the accused was acquitted in this case. And the judge sets out carefully why he rejected the evidence of the each of the three complainants. And he analyzed how their various versions of events had dramatically changed over time. And that's one of the important things a judge is going to look for. The complainants gave statements under oath to the police, which were different from statements they gave to the media, and then differed again when they gave evidence under oath, and then differed again when they were cross-examined. And some of the things which they, for example, one of the complainants made various allegations that involved things which simply couldn't be true. One of the allegations that one of the complainants made involved these claimed clear memories of things happening in a Volkswagen Beetle. And it was clear that Mr. Gomeshi didn't own the car at the time that these allegations were, these things were alleged to have occurred. So it simply couldn't be so that these things happened in the car because he didn't own it. And then there were remarkable elements of each of the complainants failing to tell the police and Crown about significant conduct and contact they had with Mr. Gomeshi after the time of the allegation. And while the judge is careful to point out that, you know, you shouldn't apply stereotypes, and certainly a person's conduct, if they were in fact assaulted afterwards, has no bearing on whether
right.
they were assaulted or not.
Right.
But it had a bearing here because they lied about it. They gave stories to the police and Crown and under oath and didn't acknowledge that.
So their lies are seen as enough that it, well, doesn't excuse what he allegedly did, but that trumps what he allegedly did. I mean, a lot of women's groups are very concerned about saying, well, he allegedly, you know, there was choking allegedly and sexual assault. I mean, within that was part of it. But how does a judge not look at that just because these women change their stories?
Right. Well, I mean, a historical case like this one, the Crown's case relied entirely on the evidence of these individuals. There were no other people who would be witnesses to it. There was no DNA evidence. There was no medical evidence, nothing. It relied entirely on their account or their claims that these things happened. And the judge concluded each complainant demonstrated to some degree a willingness to ignore their oath, to tell the truth on more than one occasion, and it is this aspect of their evidence that is most troubling to the court.
Mm-hmm. As you'd said before, it was a he says, she says.
Well, sort of. I mean, in this case, Mr. Gomeshi didn't testify, and the judge reviews that and says, well, look, you know, of course, the burden of proof is on the Crown. They've got to prove that he mm-hmm. did these things beyond a reasonable doubt. The only evidence the Crown has of that is the version of events or the evidence from the complainants. And the basics of it is that judge found the complainants to be liars. So if you have somebody who's demonstrated to have repeatedly lied under oath, and that's what the judge found, and you have somebody who is, that is their profile, somebody who's judge found in cross-examination is describing some of the evidence, dramatically demonstrated that each complainant was less than full, frank, and forthcoming in the information they provided to the media, to the police, to the Crown, and to the court. So if you've got somebody who it's demonstrated, and the judge goes through examples of how this was demonstrated, if you have a person who is demonstrated to be somebody prepared to lie under oath to the police, to the Crown, to the court, and then you say, well, that is the only evidence we have that something happened here, the result in this case is what you would expect. If the Crown says, look, I want you to rely upon the evidence of somebody who's been demonstrated to be lying, how can you accept what they had to say about the allegation? And that's really what mattered here. If the complainants had been forthcoming about other details, it may not have had the same impact on their credibility. What happened here is that each of the three complainants was demonstrated to be untruthful, and being prepared to be untruthful under oath multiple times on important matters, the judge simply concluded that he couldn't rely upon what they claimed happened in terms of the assault.
How do you think this is going to impact, or will it impact, the next trial coming up in June?
Well, they're separate, right? I mean, each individual here is analyzed individually. The judge didn't make just broad sweeping statements or draw conclusions of that sort. The judge in this case carefully and separately analyzed the evidence of each of the three complainants and carefully analyzed where it was and how they gave inconsistent statements, how it was they lied under oath, how they misled the police or Crown or the court, and then separately concluded that none of these three people could be relied upon given how they conducted themselves.
May it impact the next trial in terms of how the lawyer prepares the alleged victim?
It may, but you know, these people had counsel. It wasn't a circumstance of sort of a lamb coming into the courtroom not knowing what to expect. The complainants in this case had council of their own in addition to Crown Counsel, and they were interviewed multiple times and reminded, according to the judgment, on multiple times about their obligation to tell the truth and the whole truth and to be forthcoming about things. They were told that clearly under oath. They would have received that advice from counsel and from the Crown. So it does not appear to be a circumstance where they were provided some inadequate advice about the importance of telling the truth. It would appear on this judgment that they simply, despite that advice, chose not to be truthful.
Okay. Wow. We've got a couple of minutes here to talk about election finance laws in BC.
Yes.
Premier hosting 10 grand dinners, if you buck up.
That, in my judgment, is a serious problem. In the federal context, for the federal political system, there are now limits on how much an individual can give to a party or candidate. It's about $1,500 a year. And the idea would be set that at a threshold where you're not going to expect to be buying influence by paying money to a political party. In British Columbia, there is no limit. So what that means, and why this has garnered some attention, is that the Premier has apparently been hosting small dinner parties at a cost of, I think it's $10,000 a person, to come and sit down with her and chat about whatever people might be interested in.
Well, yeah, you want to bend her ear, get 10 grand out.
And that raises serious concerns about whether you're going to, in fact, have influence or apparent influence. And while there's no limit on the amount of money that somebody can give provincially, politicians and others should be aware of the criminal code deals with this to some extent. Section 121 of the criminal code makes it a criminal offense to be giving money to a government official for influence or for money to be accepted for that
purpose. Are you suggesting that these could be illegal dinners?
It would depend on exactly what's going on. If somebody is holding out that they can provide influence over a government minister and accepting a benefit for that, that's an offense criminally. So there should be real caution here. You know, somebody says, look, I want to give the $10,000 to the provincial Liberal Party because I support their position, I just like the Premier, well, that's fine. If you're giving the $10,000 because you want a contract or you want a change in the law that helps your company or your interests, that's, depending how that's done and what is held out, it can be a crime.
So an approvable crime then. Say that you're a contractor and you want to work on the Site C Dam and you're having a 10 grand dinner with the Premier, and suddenly you're awarded that construction contract. Would that be a case that's hypothetical, of course?
Well, here's a part of that section. It's an offense to having or pretending to have influence with the government or with a minister of the government or an official, directly or indirectly, demanding or accepting or offering to agreeing to accept for themselves or another person a reward or advantage. That's a crime.
Well, we're going to have to watch this one closely to see what comes of it, because that's it's a pretty big deal, and we are heading into, well, we're in election season. The Premier came on CFAX after 4 years, so indication of that. Thank you so much, and welcome back. It's really great to see you. Glad that you had such a wonderful time on your journey.
Thank you.
Michael Mulligan of Mulligan.